Hi guys, good morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and welcome back to Teachable Psych. My name is Sarah Jang, a host, and this week's episode features guest Dr. Bethany Teachman, a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. In particular, she investigates cognitive processes that contribute to the development and maintenance of anxiety disorders and other forms of emotion dysregulation. Now, for some countries, school may have already started or will start in a few weeks, and if this introduction interests you or even resonates, please continue listening and you might even learn something new. I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and I'll see you at the end.
Hi, my name is Bethany Teachman. I am a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Virginia and the director of clinical training there and the co-director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Thanks for inviting me.
So can you tell us about how you started getting into this field and what like motivated you to continue researching this?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was in high school, I always had an interest in the sort of helping side of psychology, in working with people who are having difficulties managing their emotions, and did a number of volunteer activities that allowed me to work with children in particular and have opportunities to work with people who are struggling in different ways. And then when I went to university, I chose to major in psychology and started taking classes and finding them really fascinating. But it was really when I started joining research labs and helping as a research assistant that my passion for psychology really grew. And I realized that it was this amazing opportunity to both do something that was sort of actively helping people, but also that I could sit around and think about like what questions I found really interesting and then figure out cool ways to try to answer those questions. And that seemed pretty amazing as a job to me. And, you know, decades later, I still do think it's a pretty amazing job to
have. Yeah, that sounds amazing. Was there any particular mentor or professor that kind of pushed you towards the field that you're in right now? Because I know you focus a lot on stress and how to regulate that.
Yeah, I've been very lucky that I've had multiple great mentors, but I think part of me choosing this field was as an undergraduate in my fourth year, I guess, as an undergraduate. So my last year, I started volunteering in a research lab led by Dr. Jack Rath, who studied anxiety disorders and how people think when they're anxious and what we can do to try to help them. And he just made the research process so incredibly fun and interesting and exciting. And I really fell in love with it. And he actually just passed away over the past year. So it's a nice chance to mention him and honor the contribution he had to me and to so many people in the field. So he really inspired me to keep going with this work.
Can you talk about a little of your first research project that you handled on your own?
Oh, goodness. What a great question. Well, I'll tell you, I don't know that it was my first, but I'll tell you about what I did my master's thesis on as a graduate student, because that's probably one of the first ones that I did sort of, you know, where I was really the leader of it. I was studying social anxiety disorder, which we continue to study today. And I was interested in trying to understand how people see themselves and in what ways they kind of distort that image of themselves. So for example, thinking that they're performing badly or don't sound good, things like that. And so what we know is that people, when they are socially anxious, rather than sort of viewing themselves just in terms of sort of looking outward at others, it's as though in their mind's eye, they're seeing what others are seeing looking at them. So it creates this kind of challenging situation where it's like, creates this self-focused attention in kind of a weird and unhealthy way, because they're constantly imagining what they appear like to others instead of focusing, for example, on what they're saying or what the other person is saying, all of those kinds of things. And so we did a fun study where we did mock job interviews to give people a chance to be in these kind of socially challenging situations. And we brought in people who are socially anxious, and we actually videotape them in different ways or put them in front of mirrors to kind of simulate this kind of like seeing yourself experience that can increase that sense of self-consciousness and self-focused attention to better understand how having that perspective can influence social anxiety.
Wow, that sounds pretty cool.
It was fun to do.
you talk about like the conclusion that came after that, and then like the briefing you gave the participants if they asked for like, oh, what can I do for myself?
So again, that study was decades ago now, so I don't remember perfectly that particular study, but I can tell you in general what we tell people. So when we debrief people, there's a number of things that we want to do to make sure we're doing our research ethically, right? So we want to make sure they understand why we were looking at the questions we were looking at and what we're going to do with the research data that they've given us. And then because we're routinely working with people who have anxiety or who are struggling in different ways, we always include information for referrals. So if they, we're not claiming they have a certain diagnosis or something, but if they are struggling, would like to get help with their emotions, we always want to include information about how they can access help and do that. But in general, what we're doing is advising people that how they think about situations can make a really big difference to do the ways that they respond. Doesn't mean that their thinking is wrong or stupid or anything like that. But for that socially anxious person, for example, you know, we could take even this conversation that we're having. Right now, you have a pretty neutral expression on your face. So that means I don't know what you're thinking. And that's okay, right? Now you're smiling. But yeah, a pretty neutral expression when I was talking, that's pretty normal, right? So if I'm a person with social anxiety who thinks, oh my goodness, people are going to evaluate me negatively, then while I'm talking to you, running through my mind really loudly is this kind of script saying, oh, she thinks what I'm saying is boring. Oh, she thinks what I'm saying is stupid. It's making it really hard for me to keep talking to you, and it's really hard for me to listen to you as well, right? Whereas instead, if what I think is like, oh, she seems to be engaged and I don't really know what she's thinking, but no reason to assume the worst, then it'll be way easier for me to focus on kind of the task at hand, which is what I want to communicate to you, listening well to your responses and questions. So again, same situation, but how you think about it dramatically changes the way that you're likely to respond and what you're likely to do. So we talk to people about what are some of the things that influence their experience of anxiety and how they can best manage it.
Yeah. So just like talk about one of the ways to manage it, because usually people that are like socially anxious, I guess like they don't realize until they're like pretty like young adult, or like they've been doing it for a long time and it's really hard to change that mindset.
Yeah. So one of the things we know is that social anxiety often onsets for people, you know, in their teenage years. But it is often 15, 20, 25 years before people seek help, which is really, really sad. And there's lots of reasons for that. One is there are real challenges in our healthcare system and things like that that make it hard to access care. But there's added elements, which is that one of the hallmarks of anxiety is a desire to avoid situations and that make you anxious. And of course, going to talk to somebody, a stranger, about your anxiety is understandably kind of a hard thing to ask somebody with social anxiety to do. So because of that, we see this kind of really long-standing pattern of avoidance. And that's really, the avoidance causes a lot of the problems that people experience with anxiety disorders, because what they do is stop then having conversations like this, going to parties, raising their hand in class, and all of a sudden their social circle's gotten really small. Their opportunities to advance academically or professionally have gotten really small because they're not putting themselves out there and taking those risks. And so that's one of the big challenges that we really see. And so we want people to understand the idea that even when you're anxious, you can tolerate that and still engage. Because as soon as you do that, the power of anxiety goes way, way down. And actually, your anxiety will go way down once you decide that it doesn't dictate your behavior.
So I guess it's like more about deciding for yourself, like, oh, I'm not going to let this anxiety control my life anymore.
100%. In fact, we use the line routinely to say, don't let anxiety make the decision for you when it's a false alarm. Like, anxiety is an incredibly useful emotion and highly adaptive. So the anxiety response when you're being chased by a bear in the woods, totally helpful for you. So listen to that anxiety. But most people start to know, like, this is probably a false alarm. It's part of my pattern of having an anxiety disorder or having a tendency towards anxiety. And so as soon as you know it's in that false alarm category, which is happening a lot for people who are prone to anxiety, then you don't want to let it make decisions for you, because it's like a broken alarm clock that's going off at times that it shouldn't be going off. Mm-hmm. So you don't want that to decide what you do.
Yeah. So you've been in this field for a while. How do you think it has changed since you've entered it, or changed the way you research things?
Yeah, it's a great question. There have been a number of changes. Some have to do with advances in technology. So that has made it easier to do certain types of, you know, analyses and statistics and those kinds of approaches. And also easier for us to offer clinical services, for example, using Zoom platforms like this and other ways where we can think about increasing access to service. So our lab does work near digital mental health. And, you know, our goal in doing that is really to make it easier for people to access care when and where they need it. Now, those are big changes that have happened in the field. I will also say the field in some ways has gotten more competitive and challenging. And I look at my students who are absolutely amazing and just really admire them and think, wow, I never would have gotten my job today if I was gone far.
I don't think that's true. So we talked about your, your past research project. Can you talk about your most recent one and if you're still working on it and how it's been developing?
Yeah, absolutely. I am lucky. I get to run a lab with a large group of amazingly talented individuals. So I have 8 graduate students right now and about 20 undergraduate research assistants who work with me. So we're a big team. And so it's pretty normal for us to have 10 or more projects going on kind of at the same time, which is keeps me very, very busy, but also really exciting. So, but I'll tell you about one kind of almost like a parent project that has lots of baby ones underneath it, which is tied to that piece I said about my interest in trying to kind of increase access to care for people and to help them shift those anxious thinking patterns that make it so hard for people to engage effectively in situations. So we offer a website called MindTrails, where it's a sort of web-based research infrastructure where people can come and participate in our research studies online and have opportunities to try out our MindTrails program. And with that program, what we're doing is rather than having somebody see a therapist, which is great, but most people don't have access to that, we're giving them lots of practice of how you can think differently when you're anxious by trying to encourage more flexible thinking, by trying to raise situations that bring up a, I wonder how this is going to go. Kind of like that example of, I wonder what Sarah's thinking of me right now. And help them to put non-threatening meanings assigned to that so that they start to think more flexibly in situations and realize, I don't really know what Sarah's thinking, but that's okay. I can handle that. And so that's a project we've been doing for a number of years now. It's an ongoing one. And we have had thousands of people do it from over 85 countries around the world at this point. So it's a very sort of large scale one, but it has lots of baby projects. So for example, we've created a version of MindTrails for teens that specifically is tailored to the things that make teens anxious. So it has things about social media in it and things like that. And we have a version that we've launched that's in Spanish. And we have a version that we've launched that's specific for members of university communities. And we have a version that we're working on right now for individuals with movement disorders like Huntington's and Parkinson's. So the idea is that there's going to be different programs that meet different communities' needs. And we're trying to really understand what those needs are and then adapt the program to try to reach out to as many people as we can.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I actually was researching that. So I had a question on it, but
sure.
So what year did this project start?
It sort of depends how you count. So the MindTrails website launched in 2016. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, we had probably a decade of doing research on what is the type of intervention that's going to be helpful online. So we use a program called cognitive bias modification to shift sort of threatening interpretations that people make. So we did lots and lots of studies in the lab to make sure that we do that type of intervention effectively. And then we adapted it to deliver it on the web, which launched in 2016. We continue to adapt it. It's definitely not in the best version that I hope it'll ever be. My hope is, and it's part of what I love about psychological science, is that you constantly try to keep improving. You get results from a study, learn from it about what worked, what didn't work, and then adjust accordingly. So for example, we are quite reliable now across studies and, you know, thousands of people at being able to shift the anxious thinking patterns. But we vary a little bit in how effective we are at reducing avoidance and other anxiety symptoms that are associated. And we also know that for our digital mental health services and for almost everybody in the field has this challenge, many people sort of come and they try it once, but they don't come back. And so they're not getting full benefits because they drop out and don't continue. And so we need to make it more engaging. So some of our work right now is really focused on, well, how do we make it more engaging? And how do we make sure that the changes in anxious thinking that happen are going to translate to changes in anxiety-linked behaviors and other symptoms?
Sounds amazing. And so since this, I guess the web was launched in 2016, have you seen any changes or improvements during COVID or prior and after to COVID, especially since we've all gone online?
It's a good question. So we know that it was a very rough period for a lot of people, particularly in those. Initially, there was a slight honeymoon, and then it was a massive increases in anxiety, depression, and various mental health challenges for lots of people during that time. The isolation, the threats involved, all of those kinds of things were really hard on a lot of people. And for some people, they've continued to struggle, but for others, they've kind of returned more to their baseline. But we did one study where we recruited a little over 600 people to come do a version of the website where we added lots of questions about their anxiety about COVID and different precautions they were taking and things like that. What we found that was interesting and encouraging is not only did people doing our program in general do better in terms of reducing their anxiety relative to people, we had a comparison condition where we gave them education about anxiety. So it helped too, as we thought it would, but our program helped more. But one of the things we saw is that that was especially the case that our program helped for people who were high in COVID anxiety. So we were excited about that because it meant it could help this population that was kind of vulnerable at that time and really struggling with what was going on in the world around them.
Wow. So after helping those that have like high COVID anxiety, could you explain like how that differentiates from just the general social anxiety you were researching?
Yeah, and many of the people would have had both, right? So we know that it, you know, people who are prone to anxiety are likely to feel anxious in a variety of situations. It's called treat anxiety. But, you know, when we ask people about social anxiety, we're asking, for example, do you worry a lot that other people are going to evaluate you negatively? Do you worry a lot that you won't perform well in social situations? We're asking about COVID anxiety. We were specifically asking, can you tell us about how much you worry about the impact of COVID on your or your loved one's lives? How much are you worried about getting COVID? How much are you worried that it's going to interfere with, you know, your health, your finances, your job, all kinds of different things, your relationships? And so we can ask targeted questions that really focus in on the particular triggers of anxiety we're interested in. And at the website, we don't just do social anxiety. We also have people coming with panic disorder, for example, or generalized anxiety disorder. So what we're doing is, again, trying to make sure that we have a variety of situations we're considering as we think about how people, helping people to think flexibly.
Well, obviously with COVID, it's not just like teenagers that worry, it's also adults. Is there a difference that you see when looking at their results when they like did the study?
So it's not really from our data, but from national data. What we're seeing is that teens are really struggling right now. So, and it is the case that rates of anxiety and depression were actually increasing for teens even prior to the pandemic. And now we see them really, really struggling as a group. And so teens and young adults, we really need to be thinking carefully and thoughtfully about how we can offer good supports for them, because it is pretty widespread, those experiences of anxiety and depression right now. For adults, as I said, we saw that spike, but many returned more to baseline. Not everybody. And we know that certain groups were more vulnerable than others, those who were experiencing greater stress during that time, all kinds of different, you know, either already had a mental health challenge going into it, they were in a caretaking role that was really, really extreme, or they were a medical provider with under incredible stress for sustained periods of time. There's lots of reasons why certain groups were more likely to struggle during this time. But from the age perspective, we do see this, you know, really upsetting and challenging finding that young adults are really struggling right now. So again, teens and sort of the emerging adulthood period, we call it, we have to pay a lot of attention to how we can help individuals at that stage.
I think also another thing is, like, most people, like you said earlier, like, if you have social anxiety, you don't want to look for situations that you're unaware of, like talking to a stranger, like therapy or something. So how do you, I guess, like, broadcast it besides just education, that there's helpful tools that they can utilize?
It's a great point. So first, I want to differentiate between sort of, as you said, almost everybody experiences social anxiety at some point. So we don't want to sort of say it's a clinical disorder when you have healthy, normal anxiety, because all of us get that sometimes. We all have times where we're shy, times where entering a situation feels anxiety provoking. That's completely normal. What we're talking about is when it reaches a point where it interferes with you meeting your goals, where it interferes with you being able to do the things you want to do, to have the relationships you want to have. So it's a pattern of experiencing anxiety in an intense way that's even kind of more than maybe makes sense for that situation. So most of us, if we're going to a social event, a party, a dinner, whatever, with people we don't know, we'll have some apprehension about that. That's pretty typical. But if you just never go as a result, or if you go and don't speak to anybody, that's where it's starting to really interfere with your ability to kind of engage in that situation. So I think that we need to have a really kind of multi-pronged approach to sharing information. We need to not just wait in our clinics for people to come to us, because that's not a good model, given all the things we've talked about. So we want information in the schools. We want information on social media. We want information through all the avenues where teens and young adults are already communicating and already getting information. So there's really interesting programs going on right now, not just even specific to teens, but more broadly, about thinking about having community members play key roles in sharing information about mental health and its treatment. So not just professionals, but training hairdressers, for example, to talk to people when someone comes in to see them, if they, loads of people tell their hairdresser that they're struggling, right? So that's a window of opportunity if the hairdresser knows to say, well, actually, I heard about this da-da-da-da-da type of program where you can get some help. So we really need to think about shifting our model away from waiting for people to come to us and shifting it towards go to people, you know, go to the places where they're already getting information, where they're already engaged, and use those as really important avenues to deliver services and deliver information.
Yeah. So since we're kind of on the topic, and it's a very broad question, so you can take it how you'd like, how do you think education and psychology is correlated or associated with each other?
Massively. So there's, you know, 8 million ways from all, you know, all aspects of how we learn, and what are the best ways to communicate information and teach students so that they learn effectively, to how they engage in the classroom, their motivation, their relationships with the teacher, their relationships with each other. And of course, you know, given what I study, it absolutely is super important as we think about managing the anxiety that many students feel tied to their schoolwork. So I'll give you one example. We know that students who experience different types of anxiety, especially social anxiety, may be less likely to raise their hand to answer a question, not feel very comfortable doing presentations, not really feel sort of open to kind of doing stuff. And it can be tempting as a teacher to just say, oh, you don't have to do that then because it's hard for you. But of course, that's in some ways not ideal, because what that does is kind of perpetuates the avoidance pattern. And then the next time around, the person's like, oh, I really can't do this. And so what they've learned is, yeah, that really is dangerous. And so what we want to instead have teachers communicate is the idea that something's uncomfortable but not dangerous, and to help scaffold opportunities. So for example, when I have someone in my class who tells me that they're really socially anxious and participation is hard, what I do is say, okay, let's make a plan. Next week in class, what I'm going to do is give you some advance notice of some of the questions I'm going to ask, so that you're not put on the spot in the same way. You have a chance to think about it and prepare. And I want you to have a goal of raising your hand once each class. But you'll have some notice about something so you won't sort of, you know, be put on the spot. Then the next week, we're going to have a goal of, you know, I don't send you questions in advance, but maybe I tell you a bit more about the topics that we're covering. And then the next week, you're not going to have that information, and we're going to still have that goal. And sometimes it's going to go well asking you questions, and sometimes you're going to think it's not going to go well. That doesn't matter. Your goal was simply to ask the question, because every time you do that, you're deciding what you do instead of anxiety. And every time you do it, whether it goes well or not, you are going to reduce that anxiety and make it easier to do it down the road. And so what we do is set these programs where we build up, making it increasingly challenging so people feel supported in doing it. And know that I've kind of got their back. And then what I can do as a teacher is, you know, when they do a response, I can really reinforce that, right? I can really sort of appreciate it, respond to it, talk about the ways that it was a helpful response to share so that it does, you know, hopefully feel like more of a success experience for people. So again, we try to move away from just like avoid the thing to how do we help create an opportunity for you to do this in a way where you feel supported?
Yeah, a great idea. As I think it helps with those people instead of like one big taunting goal, like, oh, I have to speak in class in front of however many classmates is in your class. Instead, it's being like, oh, like one, take like a week at a time rather than all of a sudden I'm into this pool that I'm not aware of.
Hi guys, and welcome back. I hope you enjoyed this one's episode as much as I did, and even learned something new that you can apply to your own life. Thank you so much to Dr. Teachman again for her insight and knowledge that she's provided. And if you're looking for further investigation into what we discussed today, feel free to check out the affiliate links I've included in this episode's description. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and I'll see you next time.